Hello, this is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show, and today I'm very pleased to have as my guest Richard Smalley, who is the author of, among other books, The Dice Game of Shiva. Richard is a world authority on mystical philosophy. He served for 8 years as the editor of Gnosis, a journal of Western inner traditions, and is currently the editor of The Quest, a members' journal for the Theosophical Society in America. Hello, Richard. How are you doing?
Very well. It's nice to be here.
Thank you. Where are you calling from today?
I'm in the Chicago area. I'm about 30 miles west of Chicago.
Okay, great. Are you still the editor of The Quest?
Yep, that's right.
I'm still doing that.
Also editor of Quest Books, which is the Theosophical Society's publishing imprint.
Right. I had an experience when I was just to become a plastic surgeon. I was guided into a metaphysical bookstore where I was guided to buy 7 of the Alice Bailey books. And, of course, I didn't read them for 7 years. It was 7 years later that I actually was guided to read them. But it was a very important part of my development. And I recently gave a lecture at the Theosophical Society here in Atlanta on spiritual protection through intuitive guidance. I'm very much interested in the concepts of that. But anyway, your book, The Dice Game of Shiva, gives some very, very important insights and historical pathways through many different religious traditions and philosophical traditions to have us understand, how consciousness and the manifested world interact and how we can understand what's really going on here. Would you like to give our listeners a little bit of background on how you came to write the book?
Well, there are lots of ways of approaching that, and historically, telling my story would take a long time. I suppose one thing that interests me, one way you could approach it, is a lot of times in mystical traditions, you see this idea that the world is illusion or Maya mm-hmm. or something like that. And this, on the ground of it, isn't very convincing because, even if it is illusory, it still seems real to us.
Right.
So let's look deeper into that question. And one of the themes you could say I pursue in the book has to do with the nature of consciousness. Now, consciousness is a very obscure concept. You can read a lot of books on consciousness and go away not really having mm-hmm. a terribly clear idea of what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I do in the book is present a definition of consciousness that I think works. It's very simple. It's the capacity to relate self and other.
Right.
And this operates at all levels, in many different ways. If there's no sense of a self or other, there's no consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
But the minute you say that, you realize that consciousness is kind of all pervasive, because nothing, human, animal, plant, animate, inanimate, is without this capacity to relate self or other.
Mm-hmm.
A plant knows how to find water in the ground. An animal knows how to seek out food and avoid predators. There's always a sense of self and other, even. And this was a point made in a book of Alice Bailey's called The Consciousness of the Atom, which I think is one of her best books. In the atom, a hydrogen atom has to somehow, in some way, be able to recognize that there's an oxygen atom there so that it can bond with it under certain circumstances and form water or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
So this principle of consciousness is all pervasive, and that's one of the points made not only in the theosophical literature, but in many other mystical traditions as well. And what I'm simply doing in this book is clarifying that and saying in reasonably, I hope, understandable terms exactly how this works and what it is. Now, this has a lot of different consequences, one of which is it clears up one mystery which is, and the neurologists, psychologists, philosophers of today are utterly unable to explain this, which is how our supposedly privileged consciousness arose out of these interactions of neurons, which are, you know, basically made up of, inanimate matter.
Right.
They really would like to answer this question, and they are usually pretending that they're just about to answer it, but it's been a long time and they never have. And I think if they go in the way they've been going, they never will. But if you see this consciousness, this capacity to relate self and others is present in everything, then our human consciousness becomes a lot less mysterious, because it's just one form of an all-pervasive thing that makes existence possible. Now, this does remove our sense of human privilege and, you know, uniqueness in being the only beings endowed with consciousness.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it does have the consolation of making us feel a lot less, shall we say, cut off from the supposedly inanimate universe.
Right. That there's a spiritual world positioned even higher on the consciousness cycle than as we are positioned above the animal world. There's a promise that we can get out of the suffering.
Right. Now, I mean, another consequence of that has to do with what you just said. Now, going back to the original question about Maya or illusion, you're, in my experience, let's say, could be basically broken down into two types of almost flavors.
Mm-hmm.
One is what we call sensory experience, of this world out there, that you see, feel, touch, and so on. The other type of experience we have is, shall we say, an inner subjective experience. Thoughts, dreams, emotions, anxieties, fears, joys, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that differentiates the two is that the second kind seems, shall we say, more private.
Right.
I can tell you about a dream I had last night, but you are unlikely to have had or seen the same dream.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things involving Maya, and to say that the entire world is illusory as well, yeah, I suppose it is, but it, in a way it's not very helpful. But another thing the mystical traditions are saying is that our stance toward the world, our understanding of the world, is somehow mistaken. And one of the things I came to, and which I describe in the book to some degree, is that we identify with the second type of experience, this inner experience. We think that's us.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas it's possible to at least have some more conceptual detachment from, physical experience. And I'm not the tree I see and that sort of thing. But we often think I'm the thoughts I have, I'm the feelings I have, and so on and so on. This is one of the causes of suffering.
Right. Identification with that which is not real.
Right. Or put it this way, it may be real as experience, but it's not
mm-hmm.
you. How do you know that? Well, you can step back and look at it from a distance. And that's what much of meditation is for.
And
so if you can see it, excuse me?
The exercises in the Course in Miracles take you through a 365-day course to undo this. And that's,
yes, that's right.
That's interesting about that particular exercise.
Yeah, that's one very specific, technique for doing it. And,
mm-hmm.
The Course is certainly very powerful, and I would certainly say one of the greatest spiritual texts of the 20th century. So that's definitely part of it.
Yeah.
But there's something in you that can detach itself from all of this experience, and it can free itself in a certain way, and that loosening of that bondage or identification is, shall we say, one of the ways out of the suffering that seems to be part of the human condition.
True. So, do you want to relate the story of the dice game of Shiva? It certainly is an interesting analogy.
Sure.
Go ahead and do that.
Well, yeah. It's it's a curious tale, and, you know, like a lot, it's well known in India. It's not very well known here. Shiva, you know, who's the Lord of the universe, is initially locked in rapturous embrace with his consort Parvati. And then one day this rather sinister yogi comes around and says, well, I can show you something that's even more fun than that. And he teaches them this dice game, which is probably an ancestor of today's Parcheesi. I remember mm-hmm. playing Parcheesi as a kid. And they get really involved in this game. And Shiva always loses. He loses everything. And this would seem somewhat weird in the story, in that, well, if Shiva's the Lord of the universe, why does he lose?
Because he's losing, yeah.
Why is he not even always losing? Right. Finally, you know, he gets down to, you know, they're betting things, and he's betting even his most essential attributes, like, you know, Shiva's associated with the trident and, you know, the loincloth and so on. Each mm-hmm. god has symbols in India as they do in the West. And he loses all of those too. And he said, well, that's okay. I've lost. I'm going to go off and live as an ascetic in mm-hmm. the woods somewhere.
Right.
Just meditating and being on my own. And eventually his wife, I guess, a little bored with the situation, comes back and entices him in the guise of a beautiful tribeswoman. The tribeswomen and the indigenous tribes people in India they'd still be regarded as untouchables in the caste mm-hmm. system, so something beautiful and forbidden. And she eventually tempts him back, and then they're sort of, you know, back together again at the end. But the story is curious in that, well, why, if Shiva's this omnipotent god, does he always lose? And the punchline is that precisely because he's God, he can lose all the time. He can lose forever, and it still means nothing. And this is, in a sense, a parable of some of the things I was talking about earlier. Shiva represents this pure consciousness that can detach itself from everything. Mm-hmm. In a sense, it loses everything. All of experience, everything that's experienced inside and out, you know, the world, you know, the news in the paper, the, you know, the trees and flowers outside, your thoughts, dreams, emotions, identity are all, shall we say, belong to Parvati, who symbolizes just experience.
Mm-hmm.
And you can detach yourself from that. It's not you. You can lose it all in the myth of the game. And, you know, in a sense, well, in a sense, you're free of that. And it liberates you from a kind of enslaved and, you know, a enslaved approach to the world.
Right.
And I think that's what many of the traditions of India and Buddhism are talking about. They don't all use the same myths. They don't all use the mm-hmm. same language or terminology. But I think they're pointing to that, and they're pointing this way in which this kind of, this true I, this true self, often capitalized, with the S is often capitalized, is, you know, is freed from what it thinks it is. It can be what it really is.
Right. And it doesn't identify with anything either given or taken away from it, so it can never suffer, and it can never, it can just recreate everything, too. I mean,
yeah,
you can lose
exactly.
everything, and then, okay, well, I've lost everything now, just create it all over again. And then once you realize that that's who you always are, then you non-attachment's pretty easy.
Yeah, and, you know, that gives, I mean, non-attachment can sometimes have a rather cold sound to it, but if you sort of characterize it as a kind of inner freedom,
right.
you know, it starts to look like a more desirable thing to have.
Yeah, it's only undesirable for those people in your life, or, you know, having expectations of you. You know, if you're a rich man who's making money and you decide to go off and seek enlightenment, then all of the people dependent on you are going to be pretty upset about it.
Yeah, that's true, but that's their particular form of bondage. And,
right.
There's nothing, you know, there's nothing, you know, perhaps even good or bad in being a rich man as such. You know, a lot of people's identities, their egos,
mm-hmm.
Are things they protect and have to enhance in kind of unwholesome ways. Mm-hmm. Not all rich people are like this, but some of them are. Yeah. You know, the idea that you have to be the biggest and best, and you have to, you know, crush your competitors, and you have to, you know, squeeze every last possible ounce of work out of your mm-hmm. employees, so you can just get richer and richer. That is that's a morally corrupt view mm-hmm. of the world, and it's one, if this rich man wants to be free in some sort of way, free of his own suffering, not just free in some, political sense, there are some real changes he might have to make in his life.
But there's also, you know, the very wealthy like J.K. Rowling and Oprah, who are incredibly giving, kind, and creative people who are a role model for the world. So, you know, you can't say one, you can't make judgments about being rich. Rich is, just is, you know.
That's very true. And as you say, there are plenty of rich people who, are very generous and very giving. So, it's not possible to just, blanket everyone. Unfortunately or fortunately true, every kind of person you could think of in terms of class, wealth, status, religion, race, nationality. There's some good people and some who are not so good.
The world of duality, which is where we're at right now.
Yeah.
So if people are able to step back, as your book is about, the process of stepping back and the history and the development throughout many religious traditions that actually come to the same point of this instruction, if people are able to step back and realize that that part of themselves that is always there, is always the observer, is always there, no matter, probably there even after death, do you think we'd have a different world? I mean, what would the world look like?
Oh, definitely. It'd
be interesting, isn't it, to try to imagine such a world?
Well, the thing about it is, one of the problems of the world today is that morality is controversial, and when there are discussions about moral behavior, the discussions are always about areas of controversy, mm-hmm. things like, abortion, health care, that sort of thing. The right
gay marriage.
All of these things are controversial, and people, can and will argue over them with good reason often. If people, and without even wanting to set all those things aside, because decisions did have to be made, if everyone focused on moral principles that everybody accepts, which basically amount to ordinary human decency and kindness,
right.
And everybody just lived by those, a large number of the world's problems would vanish overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, because everybody, thinks they know all that already and, pretends that they're living by those rules or trying to justify their actions in terms of some twisted version of those rules,
mm-hmm.
Causes a lot of problems. But, am I really being a decent person here? Am I really being honest here? Am I really trying to tell the truth and be considerate of other people's feelings? A lot of things would just simply go away.
And the other thing, too, is that one of the parts of your book when you describe, meditation, where you go within and you end up, going through these different, potentials for exploring the psychic realms and the other states of knowing and being, you talk about in the book that many masters tell their students not to get entrapped in this. One example is that the student said he saw Buddha, and the master said, keep meditating and it'll pass. But the point is that once you get to these altered states, you also can navigate through the world much better because you actually see what to do and what not to do based on these higher, energetic principles. That was one of the lectures I gave at the Theosophical Society, is how if you meditate and really bring forth your intuition or the wisdom of the observer, you really can avoid a lot of the present-day dangers. And, you know, we have a lot of present day dangers, anything from, you know, nanotechnology to GMO foods to, you know, whatever might be in the chemtrails to, you know, there's a huge number of more, I guess, pressing potential dangers in this day and age than maybe there were a couple of hundred years ago. So,
I think my view on it is that, in a sense, you have to kind of focus on, you know, the integrity of your own life, and that's not as selfish as it sounds, because
I think it's protective.
For one thing, to talk about the perspective you had, I mean, the most universal metaphor for the spiritual journey is probably, you know, going up a mountain. And one thing going up a mountain allows you to do is see the area you're in from a wider perspective.
Right.
And spiritual experience, I would say, does that. It does enable you to see your own life in a wider context. And that can be helpful. It can be comforting because it helps you see your own problems in perspective. And it also enables you to have a clearer sense of where to go. And also, you know, I mean, each of us does, and we, of course, in Miracles emphasizes this. I discuss some of this, more of this in another book I have on called Conscious Love, because it's more relevant to that subject. But everyone has a special function, and you have a role to play. It's your specific work to do. Not just in terms of what job you're going to get, but in terms of your work on behalf of humanity as a whole. Mm-hmm. Only you can know what that is. No one can tell you what it is. Other people can talk about it with other people, but only you are really going to know that. Only you are going to know what your special function is and how you most could benefit the whole. And if you have some sense of that, if you are working, shall we say, from that or with that, a lot of your actions become clear, and a lot of, you know, your fears and anxieties about the world, start to subside because, you're doing what you have to do, and you have to do your work kind of regardless.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of information about that in the popular press and even the televangelists now are emphasizing divine purpose. Certainly the movies always have, you know, there's always somebody having to go against their family or their tribe to get to their purpose. And what I think too is that if you're on purpose, mental illness is much less likely to occur, especially in form of depression. I think depression is often the cause of many depressions. I mean, not all of them. Some of them are chemical and some of them are related to things like biotoxin exposure. When people are in moldy houses, they can get extremely depressed because they don't feel well. But, you know, you get them out of the house and the depression goes away without meds. But essentially, staying on purpose is probably one of the most important things that an individual can do. And it may only be through meditation that they can find out what that purpose is. You know, it's not always that easy to know.
Yeah,
following your bliss, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just having that wider perspective or deeper or higher perspective, whatever you like, sometimes be very enlightening. Sometimes you may just wake up and realize, until I moved into this house. You know, what's going on in this house? I moved into this house, I've been depressed. Well, maybe there's something in the house that's making you depressed, whether it's mold or, you know.
Electromagnetic fields, you know.
Or whatever, yeah. The whole point is to see your situation clearly, and that it's a guide to, you know, effective action, both on behalf of yourself and on behalf of others. Yeah.
And it seems that, you know, if you take this journey of spiritual development, spiritual awakening, that detachment is actually, detachment as far as the ego detaching from the results of your action is a natural thing. It's not something you didn't have to really concentrate on. It's almost like the soul or the higher self or whatever is coming into the vehicle and taking over more and more and more and directing it more and the ego is kind of sitting off to the side, just watching things and seeing, sometimes commenting on things, you know, like, what, wait a minute, what, I don't want to go down this path, why are we going down that path, we're supposed to go down this path, you know, but essentially what happens is that the higher guidance and the higher, the more of the observer, the other, the I am that I am takes over, and that the ego finally just goes along for the ride. And that's what I sort of say it. I find myself doing amazingly incredible things that I would have never done, you know, walking up to a stranger and telling them that they have they need to go get a chest X-ray, you know, because their higher self wants me to tell them that they have lung cancer. And of course, I'm sitting here, I don't want to tell them they have lung cancer, you know, forget this. You end up doing all sorts of strange things that are very important. People come back later and say, that was incredibly important that you said that to me. Meanwhile, when I'm saying it, I'm going, what the hell am I saying to him, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But
some things get rather
bizarre.
Bizarre.
To say the least. But what, you know, one of your whole chapters is on faith, which is what I've been tested on incredibly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just the faith of being able to walk that path and not worry about people thinking you're a lunatic, you know.
And one of the things I say in the chapter is that faith is, it's not, I think in its true sense, it's not what it's often claimed to be. Most people, you know, the kid in the joke says, you know, faith is believe in what you know ain't so. And faith in that sense is kind of a blind belief in, you know, certain doctrines that may not even make any sense to you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're told to believe in X, Y, and Z in order to be saved and whatnot, and you, I guess, are afraid of not being saved, so you believe them. And I don't think that's faith in a true sense.
No, that's not real faith.
I mean,
I mean, what you're talking about is having faith in an external authority. I mean,
mm-hmm.
most religions teach that you need to have faith in an internal authority. You know, that the external authority is only good as a prop for so long.
Yeah, I think that's very true. But faith in a truer sense is also based to some degree on experience. There's some
mm-hmm.
intuition you have that there is more to the world than surfaces would make it seem.
Right.
There is a deeper road. There are deeper truths. In a way, you have a knowing about.
Mm-hmm.
The most famous definition of faith is in the Epistle of the Hebrews. Faith is the evidence of things unseen.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, it is evidence of a kind, even though it's not physical evidence. So I'd say when people have real faith, it's almost kind of an entrance point. It's a knowing of a kind, and it's an entrance point to deeper knowing.
Yeah, what I'd say to people is that basically faith to me is knowing that everything is always in divine order. And it's a knowing. It's not an opinion or a theory. It's a knowing that everything's in divine order. So whenever I find myself in a situation which doesn't seem to be in divine order, I start asking questions, and I start
mm-hmm.
investigating through the inner communication. And then I'm told why it's in divine order. And I go, oh, okay, well, that's fine. And then I'm told other things that then come to pass, proving that it is in divine order, you know, because there's a whole story, you know, it's not just one thing. It's not just cause and effect of one thing. It's everything's interwoven. And you do that long enough, and you really realize everything really is in divine order. And isn't that comforting? I mean, that's how you can kind of let go of your fear and your anticipation of bad things happening and of this, that, and the other, you know. You can just say, okay, well, it appears through experience and even remembering past things that everything is in divine order.
That's true.
And therein lies the peace of God, you know.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the most powerful, the most difficult lessons of A Course in Miracles, or can be one of the most difficult lessons,
mm-hmm.
is the one that says, let all things be exactly as they are.
Exactly. What is real is not threatened, and what is unreal does not exist.
Right.
And I've really tried to meditate on that. and go toward the real, and then the illusionary, the things that are changing all the time that are not stable, there's no sense in attaching to them. I mean, we're all going to die. I mean, you know, that's, I mean, the physical body is going to die. Now, there's a lot of evidence, in fact, scientific evidence, that, that says that the consciousness or part of us does not die.
Right.
But certainly, what I think is if everybody gets to the state where they're able to engage the world, knowing that it is in divine order, it's, mm-hmm. it's going to be a very different world. We'll be out of duality for sure.
Yeah, and also, you know, the other thing too is since everything changes, you know,
all the time.
I could tell stories about this, but there are times in my life when I've been like everybody, I suppose, upset by something in the news,
mm-hmm.
and you know, later, sometimes decades later, I'd read something and I'm like, wow. What I was upset about had absolutely nothing to do with what was going on. Absolutely.
Right.
I mean, just in a purely factual, you know, ordinary day. It's like, you know, I thought this was going on, and it was really something totally the opposite. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, going back to A Course in Miracles, it says, you know, the reason you can't judge is that you don't really know all the facts.
No, that's why you need to ask.
You know, if you knew all the facts, you know, the language of the Course, and that's where, you know, kind of where we're going, you know, the Holy Spirit is the only one who knows all the facts, and the Holy Spirit's judgment is forgiveness.
Exactly. Speaking of that forgiveness concept, I want to share a story. A few years ago, I was driving down toward I live 4 miles from my office. I was driving down, and vandals had just smashed every single mailbox on the way down. And I was just really a little furious at this senseless violence, right? So I live way down in the cul-de-sac, way away from the main road. And a few days later, my mailbox got smashed in. Nobody else's did, just mine. And so I broke into laughter saying that, you know, this is consciousness telling me not to get upset over things out there. In other words, if you get upset enough, you draw it to you. And isn't that a great, I mean, I was just laughing. I thought that was hilarious, you know.
Yeah.
But it is a lesson. It's a small lesson, because obviously replacing your mailbox isn't that big a deal. But it's a lesson not really to get upset when you see things out in the universe, out in the world. You can go ahead and try to rectify things. I mean, I try to eliminate suffering every day when I go to work. I mean, it's not that we can just let it be. But you don't need to get upset that cancer exists, or that AIDS exists, or that, you know, the swine flu exists. You know, you can actually just let it be, you know, and then still try to relieve suffering. Because you certainly don't want to get real upset about things. It's an energy that creates.
Well, it is. I mean, another thing that I think is going on is, you know, kind of the world today, something that I call kind of like the what you would call the entertainment of conscience.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's tied up. One thing about the ego, in that, you know, sense of the term we've been using it, is that above all else, it has to think of itself as a good person.
Mm-hmm.
And by getting upset about the world, things are happening, and I'm not saying they're not, getting upset about the world in a kind of anxious, purposeless, general way, the ego convinces itself it's a good person.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, almost always it does this without taking any action on behalf of anyone or anything. Its anxiety proves to itself that it's a good person.
Right.
And I think, if, you know, we're going to do something effective in the world, in highly practical terms, that kind of entertainment, which is fostered by the media, but a lot of it is set up just for
mm-hmm.
that. You know, it's something we have to free ourselves of.
That's true. I mean, you know, when I think about situations like that, I remember Jesus' words that, you know, there will be poor always. In other words, mm-hmm. it is a part of the manifested worlds to have those who do not know how to manifest. I mean, that there always will be there. So rather than, you know, rather than feeling important because you give to the needy, it's actually better to teach the needy how to manifest, you know. It's mm-hmm. like it's that's a better thing. And then also, as you say so aptly in your book, to detach from your actions, you know, so that you don't feel self-important for doing that. Your chapter 6 is called A Just Universe, and you have some interesting concepts in there about the human need for justice.
Yeah, it's very basic, and there's a, as parents and everyone, you know, will know, children have an innate capacity for what's fair and what isn't, and we want the universe to be fair as well.
Right.
We want the universe to be fair in terms that are familiar to us, and there have been a lot of ways in which the human mind has sort of adapted with this. One of this is, to use the theological term, eschatological, you know, that is to say, having to do with the end of things. The world seems unjust now, but God will put
just
it all
wait.
Right. And that was the answer first given by the Hebrew prophets, the Old Testament, and Christianity in most of its forms took that up. You know, another one is the view of karma, which is that everything, you know, is going to come back to you in one way or another. The whole point is that, you know, there is a need in us for, sort of divine justice and, a desire to, see that the world is fair. But again, it's not always going to look fair on a moment-to-moment basis, and sometimes we have to free ourselves of our expectations of what justice is.
And really, if you go more into spiritual practices, there's a number of different ones. No one religion has a priority over the other ones, but. As you go more and more into spiritual practices, there is a detachment that occurs even with things like sickness and death. I mean, I've been deathly ill since I've, attained some degree of enlightenment. And even during that horrible illness, I was totally detached from it. It was really weird. I should have been suffering terribly, but couldn't get out of bed, couldn't eat, lost 25 pounds, And yet, during the whole time, I was engaged in this education thing that I was going on with my I Am Presence educating me. And, of course, I could do nothing but sit there and learn because I couldn't do anything else. It was hilarious.
Right. Right.
So, sometimes great illness or great solitude is exactly what you need. You need to pay attention.
And,
everything else is taken out of the picture.
Yeah, definitely.
So,
but
if you look at the saints and the mystics and a lot of the stories of all religious traditions, very few people have gotten to spiritual enlightenment without having some form of fairly significant thing happen to them. Whether it's a fight going blind on the street to Damascus it does tend to come in interesting forms.
It does, and there's usually some period of unsettling, for the simple reason that you're not the things you thought you were.
Right.
You're not all of these thoughts and emotions and identities that, somehow get cooked up for us in the course of living an ordinary human life, and whatever way we're going to be taught that, and there are lots of ways, and the curriculum is, shall we say, highly individualized. It has to be taught. Some people get the message
easy, and some people get it hard. Carolyn Mason.
I don't think realistically, I've often had, lots of, times of, sense of isolation and whatnot. I don't think it's possible that some of that, I don't know terribly many people who've avoided that to some degree or another. And I say that with some reluctance because,
Well, there'll always be an exception.
Excuse me?
There'll always be an exception. I mean, you know, there's...
Well, and also, I mean, it's possible that, you know, you could come to the conclusion that, well, I should just avoid this whole spiritual journey because bad things are going to start to happen. And that's not really the way it works.
No, it isn't. No,
you know, the trials of life are going to come, you know, regardless of whether you're awake.
Conscious that they're trials, yeah. And the less attached you are to them, the less you suffer. So the whole Buddhist idea that attachment is what creates suffering is really,
yeah.
I mean, from my standpoint, it's really true. Carolyn Mace once said that in order to get from the, what she calls the horizontal to the vertical, which the vertical is where you're ascending in consciousness consciously, you have to either lose everything or think you're going to lose everything. And what happened to me was interesting. I was studying with a group of clairvoyants, seven of us, and I took 5 months off and did nothing but spiritual work, and all the clairvoyance and all the information coming in was that I was going to die within 2 weeks. And even my mother was calling me up and saying, you know, I'm really afraid you're going to be in a car accident. I mean, it was coming from everywhere. So I just sort of released everything that there was. You know, I released, that's fine, I'm going to die. I was fine with it. I still drove on the highway. You know, it took me about 6 hours to release everything. And then... A week, you know, 1 week, 2 weeks, and about 3 weeks, the clairvoyance came back and said, nope, we don't think you're going to die. So I went through the thing of thinking I was going to lose everything rather than actually having to go bankrupt and lose all my relationships and lose my house, you know. So you can create it that way, too.
Yeah, and, you know, it's true that a common metaphor for the spiritual transformation is death.
It is. I mean, this is exactly when I went through that process and developed spiritual sight and hearing and all of the other things that helped me develop a practice based on spiritual medicine. I mean, it was a very definite turning point in terms of consciousness. Like she said, being horizontal in the world where you're just living an ordinary life versus where you're actually on your path consciously and starting to detach and starting to, you know, really study. That's when I started to read the Alice Bailey books. I mean, that was exactly when, even though I'd bought them 7 years earlier. I mean, it's kind of funny, you know, you have everything you need right around you. You don't even know you need it until you look at it, and then there it is. And it's so everything's always perfect, you know.
Yeah, I certainly had books that I didn't get around to reading until years later. You know, it's always at a, you know, a necessary time, or, you know, like you, I think I certainly have to go guidance going to a metaphysical or even an ordinary bookstore and you know, finding something you need to find at a given time.
And there seems to be just a real explosion of consciousness information and, you know, talking about the various aspects of things you talk about in your book and everything, even in the popular press now. And if you think about it, even 30 or 40 years ago, if you revealed some of these principles, you could risk being put to death in certain secret societies. So it's really an interesting consciousness revolution that we're in. Some people compare it to the revolution, the revolutionary times when our country, against all odds, broke away from England, you know, even though we shouldn't have been able to.
Yeah, well, I think it's, humanity is trying to awaken at a collective level in a way that it hasn't before, and I think a lot of the prophecies, real or not, are pointing toward this. I don't know I think humanity is trying to become aware of itself, you know, as kind of a unified being in a way that it never has in human history that we know of. And with all the usual results, you know, there are large sectors of society where, you know, there's an enormous amount of anxiety about this, you know, desire to, you know, hang on to the old, you know, at all costs, you know, turn back clocks and that sort of thing. You know, it is time to move forward. Can you as an individual or I as an individual make everybody know a move forward? Well, no, not really. We're all doing our part. And, you know, it's at the very least, I think we have to keep up ourselves.
Right, yeah. I think, too, there's an awful lot of uncovering of that which was hidden.
Right.
You know, it's like if you cheated on your tax and you were a congressperson, you know, that got revealed. If there were, you know, things going on behind the scenes in the military, that got revealed. You know, things that people never thought would get revealed are now getting revealed through interesting means. And it's a way of cleaning up things, really, if you think about it. Because you've got to be aware of the problems. I mean, if you're not, if everything that is secret and is not known, you can't do anything about it collectively.
Yeah,
so all of our institutions are undergoing a cleansing, so to speak, or hopefully
that's true. And certainly,
undergoing a cleansing.
Yeah,
sometimes you wonder. Yeah.
And you know, certainly one of the main themes of the news the last, certainly at least the last decade, just enormous amounts of things that were totally hidden, possibly for centuries, of, you
mm-hmm.
know, various crimes and abuses have just been, you know, being brought to light. And it's an unpleasant process for a lot of people, especially if you had any time.
the ones that are that are invested in keeping things in the status quo.
Right.
But, you know, it's a necessary part. What I tell people is that, yes, all the institutions are crumbling, and thank God, because they're at least a large portion of them, not completely, not, you know, government, politics, business, law, medicine, but there is a portion of each of them that is incredibly corrupt and incredibly has done great harm. I mean, you know, I've written a book recently on called The Naked Truth About Breast Implants, so I am now labeled a whistleblower. You know, it's incredible how much the human mind will ignore what it does not want to see, even though it is likely to kill the person. And I see this all the time in breast implants. You know, they're dying of their breast implant problem, and yet they, because 20 doctors have told them it's got nothing to do with it, even though they're in horrible pain around their implants, and their mother is telling them that it's their breast implants that's killing them. I mean, usually the mother knows. This is the intuition coming through. They do not want to even have a simple operation that would save their life. And so I'm sitting there going, wow, you know, I mean, come on.
Well, there's another element of that, and I think you know much more about this than I do, but obviously the breast implant has a lot to do with, you know, self-image and beauty.
It does, absolutely, attachment to the physical.
Yeah, or you know, attachment to, you know, looking a certain way and that kind of thing. So that's, that must be fairly intense to watch on a day-to-day basis.
Well, it's interesting because information just came out, and they had to form a task force to look at this. About 30 patients had lymphoma cells around textured implants, both silicone and saline. So now the FDA, oncologists, the plastic surgeons, and epidemiologists are looking at this. I'm going to be very curious to see what they conclude because, of course, they've looked at things before and come up with really interesting ideas that ignored a lot of data. You know, the FDA scientists turned the FDA in for ignoring scientific data not too long ago, including that on breast implants. So, you know, we still have this influence of, you know, the corporate, I call it the multinational corporate arm of influence that is really international. It's not one country, it's international. These implant companies are international. And, there is a thing, at least a theory, out there that these corporations really control things, you know, more so than the individual governments do. And there's evidence of that. There's certainly evidence of that if you look at the decisions in Canada, the decisions in Europe, the decisions in, you know, in other countries based on the data that is ignored. So, but, you know, eventually we're going to have to take a look at everything and say, hey, wait a minute, you know, we need to come up with a better idea. You know, it's like, you know, we need a better idea. You know, why not just come up with something different that works? But anyway, well, we're coming to the end of our hour. It's been a real pleasure interviewing you. And,
well, it's been a pleasure to be on. It's a very fascinating conversation.
And would you like to give any contact information for our listeners?
If you're interested in my works, you know, they're available on the the usual sources online and bookstores. Mm-hmm. My name is Richard Smoley, S-M-O-L-E-Y. One of my previous books is entitled Inner Christianity, and my website is innerchristianity.com. So if you can log on to that, you'll find out information about my other books.
Can you name your other books for me?
Sure. Actually, the latest one that's just come out in a new edition a couple of days ago is a new edition of a book of mine called The Essential Nostradamus, which is a translation and a discussion of his various prophecies.
Well, I'd love to have you on to talk about that. We need to do that.
Yeah. Inner Christianity, Hidden Wisdom, which is a guide to the Western mystical traditions, Conscious Love, Forbidden Faith, which is a history of the Gnostic and mystical legacy of Western civilization. So those are my books.
Great, great. Well, I'll get in touch with you about the Nostradamus book, because prophecy is very, very interesting these days, because of course a lot of the if you look at the Hopi prophecies, Nostradamus, the ancient Jewish prophecies, the Roman prophecies, the Christian prophecies, I look at all of them and try to correlate everything that's coming right around now, because of course now seems to be a pretty interesting time at the end of a 26,000 year cycle that many of the prophecies pointed to. So it's like a puzzle, putting everything together.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun. Well, thank you so much for joining us. It was great. Next week we're going to be interviewing Dr. Staninger, Dr. Hildegard Staninger, on toxicology, things like Morgellons, breast implant problems, get a toxicology update, things in your environment that you might want to avoid. And then we have Dr. David Biro, The Language of Pain, Finding Words, Compassion, and Relief. And certainly in this day and age, there's a lot of pain out there, and we see it every day in the clinic. Then the next week we have Deborah Green, Endless Energy, The Essential Guide to Energy Health, Who Wouldn't Want More Energy? And then on the 15th, Dr. Georgiade with Curing the Incurable with Holistic Medicine. Every third Thursday, we have Noetic Science. I just gave one of the Noetic Sciences last week, and I'm not sure of the May lineup, but if you want to call 770-457-4677, or look on our website, www.templeofhealth.ws. I want to remind people that we have a couple of years of radio interviews up. We've been doing this show for 17 years. I think I have at least 5 years up on the Internet for free, www.plasticos.com, under resources, under radio. If you missed the show, you can catch it there. Well, thank you very much. Richard, I'll certainly be in touch with you about the Nostradamus book, and maybe we can do some of your other books as well.
Great. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure, and I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
Sick and tired of always feeling sick and tired, and I don't want to take a lot of prescription drugs to feel better. Isn't there a better way?
Millennium Healthcare offers natural solutions to your health problems. Millennium Healthcare is qualified healthcare professionals working with you to restore your health and wellness. Whether it's a caring physician, one of our natural providers, or our natural apothecary, Millennium Healthcare can help. For more information, call Millennium Healthcare at 770-390-0012. That's 770-390-0012.